This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 19th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 418. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, the MMA panel returns for the third quarter of 2025, with Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program. Plus, more from Alan Mullen, former Correctional Service of Canada manager and former Chief of Staff to Speaker Darrell Plekis, and Paul Stanley, the BC government's former Chief Security Officer. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. So here we are at Apollo's and Commercial Drive. This is the MMA panel on the Breaker.News podcast. And of course, go Mariners. Fred ends up, sees the moment. Over here is Mario, that's the M, Mario Canseco from Research Co. I'm the other M, Mackin. And over here is the A, Andy Yan, the Duke of Data, from the Simon Fraser University City Program. And here we are, it's autumn in Vancouver. We're a year away from the next civic election, and a lot is happening on that front. Big news over the summer. This is our quarterly look back about what happened and what didn't happen and what could happen in the coming weeks and months. The big news over the summer for Ken Sim, the summer of Sim. He got rid of city manager Paul Mokry. We find out later that he's going to be eligible for about 2 years of severance, so $750,000 or so coming to him. In his place, Donnie Van Dyke from Delta. That's who is now the city manager, and he's got big directions from the ABC City Council. Zero means zero. A 0% tax increase is what's on order for 2026, the year that Vancouver's hosting the FIFA World Cup, the biggest, most expensive endeavor since the 2010 Winter Olympics. We'll start over here with Mario Canseco of Research Co. Zero means zero. Is this possible at all, or is that just a great slogan?
It's a good slogan. I wouldn't say it's a great slogan. It's particularly problematic because of the fact that we're having the World Cup in Vancouver, but also because it's an election year. And we need to remember that this particular council wasn't very good at planning a by-election just a few months ago. And now we're going to be heading into an election which conceivably could also include a referendum on the park board if they get their act together and decide to add another line to the ballot. So it's a delicate balance. You know, you can say you're not going to get this property tax increase this year. You've had it for the last couple of years. But if that is going to take away resources that are required to plan for the World Cup and to have an election that goes better than the by-election, that's a problem.
Andy Yan, Ken Sim promised a swagger when he came in 2022, but there's only been subtraction. Subtraction right. From ABC, from his caucus. And with a year to go until the next municipal election here in Vancouver, the two challengers, one is Karim Alam, his former chief of staff, his campaign manager who elevated him to power in 2022. There, of course, there was the firing that happened in early 2023 when Karim Alam became the ex-chief of staff in the mayor's office. And more recently, earlier this year, turfed out of the caucus was Rebecca Bly, who was elected originally in 2018 with the NPA ticket when Ken Sim was running the NPA ticket, lost narrowly to Kennedy Stewart. Of course, you've got Vancouver Votes is the party for Rebecca Bly, and Karim Alam is the Vancouver Liberals. Mm-hmm. You've got these two challengers. Do you think these two challengers really want to become mayor, or they want to get even with Ken Sim?
Well, that's an interesting question, because for all the ambition these folks have listed out in terms of what they want to do in the city of Vancouver, they're going to need a team. And I think that this is going to be one of the interesting things, not only to kind of see the kind of platforms and the kind of, kind of charisma that they have in front of voters, the individual as mayor, as a prospective mayoral candidate, but it's really the team that they can build around themselves. And I think that that's really going to be the challenge, is to see who's going to agree to join which team and how they're going to run in terms of being a functional party, because I think over the last couple of years we've seen the kind of dysfunction in civic parties, and I think that it's going to be an interesting kind of race in terms of who the additional candidates will be in addition to their announcements to being a mayoral candidate.
Do you think there's a bit of an identity crisis here, that Rebecca Bly and Karim Alam will have to define themselves and maybe answer for some of their previous past positions? I mean, Karim Alam has been a federal conservative. He was involved in the BC Liberals. He was instrumental in the ABC Vancouver, which tried to portray itself as a big tent party appealing to people across the spectrum.
Right.
Then he went, this time last year, endorsed the NDP and David Eby. Now he's running the Vancouver Liberals. And Rebecca Bly, of course, was with the NPA, then went independent, then joined ABC, has gone independent, now with her new party, Vancouver Votes. Do you think that's going to be an issue with the voters? It will probably be an issue with their opponents, but do you think it will be an issue with the voters? What do both of you say?
Well, I think that's exactly it, is what can you think about those platforms? I guess this kind of political intersectionality that is, I think, occurring, I think, between these two these two candidates, I think, leads on to some interesting questions about what are they actually about, what their long-term vision towards the city of Vancouver will be, simply because they've, I think, had all these different features. But then one might also note that it kind of gives the differences in Vancouver politics of how people can be very different, whether they're at the civic, provincial, or federal levels.
It's a very good point. You know, you can look at the election of Ken Sim and say, we got 51% of the vote with somebody who was relatively unknown, who had a cohesive team behind them, with a turnout of 36%. Can we get 18% of people in Vancouver to vote for us? Of course, if you have the right team behind you. And that is going to be one of the essences that defines where this campaign will go. If you actually have a team of councillors behind all of these new mayoral candidates that people want to support. I mean, it was a little bit easier for ABC because we were coming off that year where Kennedy Stewart was the mayor and we didn't have a lot of, essentially groups voting together within council. This time around, it's more, you know, do we want to do what ABC did and essentially take over? It's going to be hard to do when you have so many candidates who are credible.
And I think it's going to be interesting to kind of see which candidate is going to activate which part of the city. I think one of the things you have to note about Ken Sim and his campaign was the fact that he was able to activate the entire southeast corner of the city of Vancouver, that almost every other previous election in the city's history just kind of ignored, but yet he was able to kind of ride that into power versus, say, this traditional civic crescent. With where we are in Granville Woodlands, right up to about Kitsilano Point, West Point Grey, that used to be the kind of civic crescent that determined the face of the mayor, much less the kind of traditional kind of east-west politics with the west side determining who would be mayor. That it's in a way it's in flux, but yet I think that this is going to be an interesting element to kind of see which candidate is going to activate which part of the city of Vancouver.
Now here we are expanding to the region, looking at Metro Vancouver and all of its problems with the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant, which just has not gone away. You've got mayors who have been instrumental within Metro Vancouver for so many years who are going away. Malcolm Brody is calling it quits at the end of this term. I mean, he really is in many ways unelectable after the gift card scandal at City of Richmond, at Richmond City Hall, as well as the scandals of expenses and vacation junkets for people involved with the Richmond Olympic Oval. You've got, of course, Malcolm Brody and his high salaries, additional salaries for extracurricular work. He's just one of many power brokers at Metro Vancouver. Mike Hurley, of course, the mayor of Burnaby, is the current chair, and Metro Vancouver decided to put a kibosh on its internal review of the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant because of the 2027 trial with Acciona. Mm-hmm. But people are seeing the cost mount on their bills. They've seen how Premier David Eby has basically given it lip service, said, oh, well, they'll step in if they need to step in, but they won't step in. They haven't stepped in. They're stepping away from it. And do you think that this time next year, will voters go to the polls and perhaps even have a throw the bums out movement, especially on the North Shore, where there's been a bit of a lack of political leadership in taking charge of this very large expenditure, which should have been finished in 2020, which should have cost $700 million, but is on its way to $4 billion for 2030.
Right. Of course, I'm totally biased because I just finished an op-ed piece with Ken Cameron and Richard White in terms of the discussion of the importance of Metro Vancouver. So, kind of declaring my own biases that I mean, there is very much this core function of Metro Van, and you got to remember, it's an entity that's responsible for liquid and waste management, in addition to water as well as air quality. That those are the core legislative functions of Metro Vancouver, and those are things we need. And I think that indeed, with a growing region, that we're going to need even more. And yet, the issue is how should it be governed? How should those services be provided in a way that's affordable? Who should pay for maintenance as well as new capital projects? And I think that this is really part of that pain, and ultimately it's a question of leadership both at the provincial level as well as the municipal level. And I think that it's also going to be, I think, a bit complicated simply because of the amount of decisions that have been made at the provincial level that used to be done at a local level. And really now you can make all these orders, but ultimately who pays the bills?
It's a very good point. You know, we're having discussions about low turnouts, mayors who are leaving, discussions about the future of council. I think one issue that is going to be discussed more than in previous municipal elections is amalgamation. Maybe not as far as the entire Metro Vancouver area becoming one municipality, but maybe looking into the land lease, looking into the North Shore, looking into possible areas that could be working better if the services were amalgamated. The other complexity is there's a certain separation between the decisions made by councillors who participate in Metro Vancouver and the people who are out there saying this is now over budget. There's that sense of detachment from people who voted for many of these things happening, and it's always the same bureaucrat who comes out and says now this is going to be $1 billion more than it was before. So unless we figure out a way to make that governance more responsive to the needs of the people, this is going to continue.
But I think at the same time, I think many a person has kind of enjoyed fantasy amalgamation. You know, which municipality should merge into which municipality? And I think the challenge is, in one way, on the kind of surface, it's really kind of interesting to say, hey, maybe you should have a North Shore, or maybe all the Langley should come together. But when you go through the details of infrastructure, of capital improvements, of taxes, of services, that's where it gets really, really messy. And in that instance, you actually realize that there are some of these prospective partners really shouldn't get married, that they shouldn't get together, because it would actually be really expensive for one of the partners. And would that be such a great idea in reality as opposed to being on paper? And I think that this is really the interesting thing about kind of amalgamation, when you kind of take it from one level and move into the specific details, that it actually gets to be a lot more challenging.
Now we go from talking about municipal amalgamation to provincial division in so many ways. Here we are with the latest version of the MMA panel. We've got some new dynamics. We've got constant infighting in the provincial conservative ranks after John Rastad kept his leadership after a rather underwhelming vote tally. About 1,300 members voted and 900 said keep Rustad as the leader, so he stays as the leader, but we've seen some subtraction since then. Eleanor Sturco, high profile MLA, gone from the Conservative caucus. Then on the other end of the spectrum, the BC Greens. Emily Lowen is their new leader, but she doesn't have a seat in the legislature, but they do boast well over 3,000 votes for her. So, you know, she's more popular among the Greens than John Rustad is among the Conservatives right now. And at the same time, I think there is going to be some questions about David Eby's leadership. You know, there's a party convention coming up, and there's some dissent among some in caucus, very quiet. There's the environmental wing, which isn't happy that Eby's become a cheerleader for LNG. And there's still a lot of industrial workers unhappy that they decided to buy ferries from China. And of course, we're sitting here right now. It's October 15th, and unless something changes radically in the next few days, unless Vince Reddy suddenly comes along with his cape to save the day, the BCGEU strike will continue. Liquor stores, cannabis stores are the big revenue generator for the province, and they're affected heavily. So where do you think it's going for David Eby? Who has the best outlook in the coming weeks and months, maybe even a year, among these three political leaders? Should David Eby be worried that the descent that has befallen the Conservatives will visit the NDP ranks?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things that I don't think for now, but then, of course, it goes into how most of our governing entities or who's in power right now is in one way there because of the weakness of their opposition. It's not necessarily strictly all about the strength of their governance and their policies, but it's actually the weakness of their opposition and the lack of an alternative. And I think that that's really going to be the interesting thing to watch, is that should there ever be a alternative to the NDP, you kind of wonder what would happen to David Eby, because of just really simply because of just how uneven the discontent is across the province. That, I mean, what's happening in, say, Vancouver is a lot different from, say, what's happening in Surrey or the Fraser Valley. And I think that this is really going to be interesting to kind of watch for the NDP, because it's not only, say, the Lower Mainland, but it's really Vancouver Island that has several seats for them to kind of see whether they're able to maintain it. But I mean, similarly with the Greens, I wonder if it might be also part of a generational change. Like, if you look at really look at the new Green leader, she's a new generation. Like, she is like, I don't even say she's not a millennial, she's a Gen Y. I mean, she's even after the millennials, and I think that that really marks perhaps a possible turning point in BC politics, really of generational change. And I think where it's going to go, I think it's ambiguous, but yet at the same time, it's also one of just really all these factors federally, globally, that I think is making, I think, a level of just uncertainty for everyone.
Yeah, Mario Canseco, here we are, basically a year since the 2024 election. Research Co. was for many months before and has for many months since seen the big three double-digit issues. Really very little movement there. They're still on the top of British Columbians' minds. They're still unsolved. Housing, poverty, homeless, economy, jobs, and healthcare. Those three, they might change position every once in a while, but go up and down, titch here or titch there, but it's really been the same. And we're not seeing David Eby fast enough solve those problems, and we're also not seeing the opposition come forward with viable solutions to really push the envelope. Here we are, it's almost been a year of nothing in many ways.
Well, I think the big difference is the level of organization from the opposition. You know, you look back at the late 1990s, with unemployment rising as it is right now, with labor disputes as we have them right now, with people concerned about inflation and the cost of life as we are right now, the Conservatives should be significantly ahead of the NDP. But I think it's become pretty clear that John Rostad is not Gordon Campbell. He hasn't been able to recover the rapport with voters that he lost during the televised debate. His numbers haven't been the same since. There's been a complexity in trying to connect with voters, particularly voters age 55 and over, who seem to be not overly satisfied with what the NDP is doing under David Eby, but not ready for the change that the Conservatives need from voters. I think that is the biggest difference at this particular stage. Your over 55 voter used to be a BC Liberal. It is now a BC NDP voter who is going to need a lot of coaxing to come back into the fold.
But I think what's interesting about the liberal or the conservative liberal role, whatever they call themselves now, the conservatives, is that really it's actually how hard it's been for them to pierce the suburban urban vote.
Yeah.
Like that, I think that when it comes to the BC Conservatives, they very much do cover the kind of rural, the northern areas of the province. But when it comes to the kind of vote-rich, seat-rich, urban and suburban areas, they're not able to pierce that yet. And I think that that's really, one to kind of see whether they're able to do that or not.
We're gone with Thanksgiving, looking forward to Halloween, the spooky time of the year. And a lot of spooky things have happened federally in recent months. Of course, the rise of Mark Carney and the decline of Justin Trudeau. Of course, if you think his new romance with Katy Perry is a decline, well, we can debate that some other time. A lot of people would be quite happy for him for that. But in that spirit, trick or treat, we got to look at some of the main leaders of the federal parties. Pierre Poilievre is back in the House of Commons. Of course, he lost his seat to Bruce Fanjoy on election night, but campaigned throughout the summer in Alberta. And he's back in the House of Commons as the opposition leader, as an Alberta MP. What do you think of his fortunes? Is it trick or treat for Pierre Poilievre at this time and in the months to come through 2026?
The treat is that he's got a seat in the House again. We saw the numbers really dropping when he wasn't in the House, people not paying attention to the Conservatives or to him as the leader. I think there's a bit of unfinished business when it comes to making sure that the voters who looked at them very seriously when they compare them to Justin Trudeau can do the same thing when they compare him to Mark Carney. Looking at the over 55 vote, solidly behind the Liberals, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the housing file, and I think that's going to help him with the younger crowd. And the 35 to 54-year-old voter more likely to be worried about the economy and jobs. If that group starts to look at the Conservatives as a better option for the finances of the country, then the Conservatives can climb back to the place they had for most of 2024.
Pierre Poilievre, trick or treat for him from your standpoint?
Well, I think Pierre Poilievre's nemesis and his strength has always been running against Justin Trudeau. Now, the whole thing is somebody needs to mention to Pierre Poilievre that Justin Trudeau is no longer prime minister. And I think that it's interesting to kind of see him try to use the same comments and the same tactics on Mark Carney. And I don't think it works. Like, I think they're kind of like the kind of issues and challenges that are facing where we are today are so different that I don't know the kind of tactics that Poilievre is using in terms of countering or providing the alternatives to Mark Carney is really working. And I think that it's really going to be, I think, an element of him trying to recalibrate himself to the fact that he's no longer running against Justin Trudeau, but he is fundamentally dealing with somebody who's very, very different from him. And I think that so far, he hasn't really kind of come into anything, I think, of substance when it comes to housing, when it comes to the economy. But yet at the same time, our country itself is facing its own challenges. I think that in dealing with really what happened with the immigration file, I think the substantial loss of the immigration consensus shared within Canadians, I think really is part of the major challenges ahead of us in terms of economic well-being. We now have unemployment rate of, I think, what, 7.1, 7.2. I mean, those are big numbers. And really, what is the strategy moving forward in terms of decreasing unemployment, but at increasing our productivity? I think that it's still challenging. And I think with Mark Carney, it's seeing his activities internationally is interesting, kind of see a certain level of success there. But yet, when it comes to domestic politics, much less Canadian American politics, it still seems to be fairly open towards what will happen.
And on the other end of the spectrum, the NDP, which lost big time on election night, Jagmeet Singh out as leader, the party didn't achieve official party status in the House of Commons, but now you have a leadership race. Is anybody paying attention to this leadership race anywhere? I mean, it's a perfect time for it because here we are in the period of Halloween, people are going to the pumpkin patch and looking at
Orange
everywhere and trying to figure out which one is the best shape, which one is still firm, which one is mushy. Is there anyone in this NDP leadership race that is going to inspire anyone to give that party a look in the next election?
Well, I think the interesting issue is that it's orange mixed in with a bit of green. And I mean, what happened to the Green Party? And I think that this is a really interesting moment for third parties and the kind of issues. And I think I saw something that was, where did I read it? It's really dealing with the kind of
uncertainties moving forward, that there's a tendency to kind of polarize, and that third and fourth parties really struggle in that type of environment. So it's not only the NDP, but also the Greens in terms of who they are, where they are. And I think that, you know, on a federal level, I think that especially with what's happening in terms of Trump, I think that this is really not a conducive environment for the NDP or the Greens, and yet they seem themselves, I kind of wonder, are they still even around?
And Mary Canseco, as we close out this edition of the MMA panel, trick or treat, best for last, Mark Kearney. Mr. Elbows Up, earlier in the year, he was going to save Canada because Donald Trump wanted to take us and break us, and here we have actually a rather cordial relationship between Kearney and Trump, two guys that know their way around the real estate business. Is it trick or is it treat for Mark Kearney?
I think the trick was the way in which this was portrayed during the campaign. Now we're finding out that it's very complicated to try to maintain that same level of discussion when it comes to all things Trump. There's a significant decrease in the proportion of Canadians who are still worried about whatever Trump is going to do. I think we've hit that stage, kind of like the mid-season in hockey, when you kind of know that the team isn't going to make it and you're just going to watch the games if you have an opportunity. We're only, 6, 7, 8 months into the Trump presidency right now. It's going to take another 3 years, more than 3 years, depending on how the situation unfolds. And Canadians are looking at domestic issues more than they did before. So the timing for a campaign based on who's best to manage Donald Trump helped them immensely. I think that was the trick. But there's a complexity in trying to show a treat to Canadians in the form of a better managed housing file, a healthcare system that is funded properly, and more importantly, the economic conditions for the country. Those are the things that they have to figure out in the next 6 or 7 months. Because people have gotten used to dealing with Trump. They know that it's no longer Pierre Poilievre who's going to be dealing with Trump, and that puts people at ease a little. But that doesn't take away all of the domestic concerns that many Canadians are voicing right now.
And I think really what's going to happen, I think really will be laid out in terms of the federal budget, or the different kind of ways that they're going to lay out the federal budget now. And I think that that's really going to be where the proof is in the pudding, is really what's going to be, what is going to be funded, what's going to be cut in terms of the federal budget. I think it's November, I think is it mm-hmm. really is
yeah, November 4th.
November 4th is the first cut. So I think that's really going to be really, I think, telling towards what the Kearney government truly sees as a priority and what it doesn't.
Well, on that note, it'll be elbows up and elbows up with my coffee and and because I'm wearing the Mariners, it's also Tridents Up. Go Mariners.
Yes.
The MMA panel, that's is Mario Canseco, the first M with Research Co. I'm the other M, Mackin. And we got the A, Andy Yan, the Simon Fraser City Program Director. Ellen Mullen is the former Chief of Staff to Darrell Pluckis, who was the Speaker of the Legislature from 2017 to 2020. And Paul Stanley is the former Chief Security Officer for the British Columbia government from 2017 to 2022. 2025, political violence is one of the major talking points, mostly happening in the United States, of course. One incident that happened on October 5th, close to home, just across the border, hasn't got much attention, but someone broke into the Washington State Capitol, went on a rampage, tore down flags, toppled statues, lit fires. He was arrested, which is the good news. But the fact that someone would be able to break into the seat of government in Washington State, so close to British Columbia, must be a concern for anyone who operates these important buildings. Paul, what do you think about that incident, and do you think that the BC legislature is properly secured as it is to prevent someone from doing the same thing?
$64,000 question, Bob. Violence in any form is never appropriate, never, because we live in a democracy, and the whole idea is if you have a difference of opinion, you voice it in a political way. You voice it in a democratic way, and you enable discussion to happen and to take place. But you know, the one thing that I will go back to is that not everyone thinks that way. And of course, if you've got someone who has an ideation and they want to make a statement, they have to do something physical in order to impress everybody that they mean business. We've had this a lot in this province. Certainly my office ran a team along with help from the police and the sheriffs to look at threats made to the government and to government employees. And they were many. Now, many of them are simply people making a statement out loud, using social media, all that kind of thing to voice their discomfort, to voice their opposition. But nevertheless, there are those that will step forward. Case in fact, Bonnie Henry during the COVID crisis. She was, like her, don't like her, it doesn't matter. She was doing an amazing job that John Horgan gave her to do in a very, very tough situation, helped by Adrian Dix, but nevertheless, she was front and center every single day. Now, she ended up with an RCMP protection detail because some people decided they didn't like her and they offered threats of violence. That's wrong. And to break into it's the January 6th all over again. It's happened in most democratic environments over the years. Do we believe that the legislature is adequately protected? You know, my professional paranoia says, if I want it adequately protected, it's a fortress and you don't get in. But that's not how it works, because you have to give the ability to the people to come to the people's house in order to do the business of the government. And so there's always a compromise. And whenever you have that compromise, you have risk. Now you fill it by using layers of support. You put cadres of different items together that enable you to fill those gaps effectively and provide so many means of deterrence that people do not get to do what they want to do. One of them is the building itself. The other is technology. Another is personnel and processes and procedures and policies. Those things all come together. And if they work well, you have a good system. But you know what? Patently, it didn't happen in Washington. And someone was able to get in. The rogue will always get in and do what they want to do. Look what happened a few weeks ago where they put the flag up outside the legislature. You know, and it seems at the time, how did that happen? What do you mean, how did that happen? You've got technology there. You've got cameras. You've got guards. You've got officers with guns walking around all the time. You've got the police patrolling the area as well. How did you not know? Well, that's it. That's what happens. But in a democracy, wherever you, unless you want to shut it all down and put razor wire around it, Bob, you're going to get compromised.
Number of cyber breaches over the years, but you know that protest banner that was back in August, and that was a security breach as well. And as Paul said, like, how does that happen? But to your point, and it's a very good one, when you have that many people, you know, whether it's at the you know, cabinet offices downtown Vancouver, or whether it's at the BC legislature, you know, it creates a distraction. And you'll recall back when I was in the speaker's office at the legislature, we had a number of protests that went really quite nasty, where they were lighting fires and, you know, spitting on members as they were going in. That's not okay. And we're seeing it more and more and more. And sometimes it's politically motivated. And then sometimes it's a vehicle for those high tensions, you know, high emotions, as you just referenced, Bob. Look, we've seen not that long ago, the former speaker of the Minnesota legislature assassinated. You know, the Charlie Kirk murder was politically based as well, to a degree. We're seeing Washington. You know, I know, because I've spoken to many ministers and even members for that matter who are really quite concerned about that. You know, this increase in political violence, whether it's politically motivated or not, is sometimes not even the case. It's sometimes, like you say, it's, you know, just emotions, high emotions, whether it's based on unions or one thing or another. And sometimes it's just a statement. I mean, there is, you know, mental health issues out there as well. And, you know, I know that the lieutenant governor in this province and across the country are saying, well, you know, I'm the king's representative here in the province, the governor general being the king's representative for the country. You know, what about them? Where's their protection? The premier has an RCMP detail. Well, what about ministers? You know, if the minister of health for some reason gets blamed for ER closures or whatever the case, they're at risk and they know it. And I'm not sure. I think we need to take a real hard look at it and get serious about it. I mean, yes, it's money. Yes, it's this. Yes, it's that. But something's going to happen here, and something more. And I've had the conversation with the current and former Solicitor General where something's going to happen. It's not just going to be hanging a banner. And I think we as a society, but more importantly, they as government need to get serious about those issues, whether it's protection of the people's house, whether it's protection of the ministers of the crown who are there doing their work, whether you agree with the work or not, protection of our public officials. We need to get serious. And you referenced at the beginning of our interview here, we have the FIFA World Cup coming up. Well, if we can't get serious about protecting, you know, the base, you know, folks and issues in our society, how are we going to protect when the world comes knocking, when the world comes to visit? And we need to get really, really serious about that conversation. And it needs to be a public conversation, in my view.
FIFA World Cup, you know, it's October 9th, 245 days until the kickoff in Toronto, and then 247 from today when we're recording until the kickoff in Vancouver. But they got to be ready much, much sooner than that. Months before then. I was asking Public Safety Canada this week about their preparations, about their budgeting, and they tell me they're using money from existing resources. That's the ministry, of course, that includes the RCMP, the Canada Border Services Agency, and other federal security and safety agencies. The provincial government is waiting for a multi-party agreement to be signed. It seems like there is not much organization here. And this is a very complex event because it involves partnership with the United States and Mexico to carry on this tournament, the biggest sport event ever in history for a single sport. And it seems like it's not getting the attention and the budgeting and the resources it deserves and it needs.
There's something to bear in mind here. Excuse me. The FIFA as an organization is very, very, very stringent on its regulations and its standards, even down to branding and all those kind of things. So that, you know, we've seen these horror stories already of local businesses around BC Place not being able to function because they come within this exclusion zone that FIFA are going to set up. Now, FIFA have been doing this for a long time, and what they've got is they've got tomes of regulations saying, if you want to do this, you have to agree to these conditions. So they are driving the bus for the three nations that are involved, regardless of who it is. Now, obviously, the US are taking primacy on this because they're hosting the larger amount of the events, and we are very much the third parties in all of that. But so much of this is prescribed already, and you simply have to comply, or you don't hold the event where you want it. That's it. There's no gray area with the FIFA. It's us. It's our way or the highway. And so there's an element of that attached to it. And part of that element is the confidentiality of the processes that they're putting in place and the monies that are being spent. They do not disclose. And you know, I know, Bob, that you've spent a career trying to find out those kind of things from all manner of different sources, with some great success, I might add. But at the same time, FIFA are a closed book. Now, when it comes down to us at the provincial level, at the municipal level, taking this seriously, yes, obviously everyone needs to be. They need to be involved in it, and they have to have their own pace in order. Now, the budgets for the various organizations, I happen to be friends with a number of people who are involved in this in the committee for preparation, and it's coming together in the various guises. It's just not, as I understand it at this moment, a cohesive budget. But when it gets presented to FIFA and we say, this is what we are doing in Canada, they will look at it and they will agree, yes or no. And they will say whether or not we have done enough. And it's up to the various entities, be it the police officers, the police agencies having jurisdiction, be it CSIS, the provincial government, transport, TransLink, everybody else has got to put all of their individual budgets in. BC Place, same thing. All of it's got to go together, be put together, and then FIFA give the yes or no on it. That's how I understand it works. It's very tight.
I wonder if there is any political aspect to this, because during the lead up to the Vancouver 2010 Olympics, the original bid book had the lowball number, $175 million, and that was presented after 9/11. And people, once they saw that number, said, is that going to be enough for such a complex event? And then, of course, it became a storyline on its own, quite a political controversy, and eventually the number was set at $900 million. To bring in thousands of police officers and soldiers from across Canada.
I jest about this, but look what happened in the UN the other day. The president visited, the escalator stopped, and then he couldn't get his teleprompter working. Those are the things that grabbed the highlights, and yet nobody got hurt. No, nobody went to jail. You know, nobody needed first aid. It's this will be a huge event where, if anything happens, it will be so devastating to us that we cannot afford to take the risk. And so contingencies have to be put in place. They really do. And I've got my fingers crossed and everything else crossed that we're going to have a great tournament. I'm really looking forward to it. But it's going to be. I'm glad I'm retired.
I'm with you, Bob. I think the government needs to have the public conversation. They owe it to the public. They owe it to everybody to have an open and transparent discussion. Because as you've mentioned, in 2010, went from $175 to almost $1 billion. And obviously they're always reluctant because there's opposition. There's people for the tournament, there's people against the tournament. But the bottom line is it's not good enough to do it, you know, just before the tournament or even afterwards and say, oh, look, it ballooned to $1 billion or $1.5 billion for security because we had to appease FIFA, like Paul referenced. So I think that conversation needs to happen. I think it needs to happen now because the public wants to know. And at the end of the day, it's the public's money, isn't it? So I'm with you. I hope the conversation starts, and I hope it starts soon.
Podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Focus Taiwan.tw, Ministry of Digital Affairs plans to block TikTok on school Wi-Fi networks. A nationwide ban would require social consensus due to its implications for freedom of speech, said Digital Affairs Minister Lin Yi-Chin. Lin made the remarks in a legislative session during which Kuomintang legislator Hung Meng Kai called for a total ban in schools of the social media platform developed by the Chinese company ByteDance. Minister of Education Cheng Yingyao said in a separate legislative session that his ministry will respond through both campus rules and media literacy education to help students identify misinformation. In ABC News Australia, more work to be done. Minister apologizes for crime stats bungle. Queensland's police minister has apologized for the release of bungled data that overstated a reduction in the number of victims of crime in the state. The Queensland Police Service said human error was to blame for the incorrect figures, which were announced by Premier David Crisafulli at a press conference last week. The data indicated that between January and September of this year, the number of victims of crime in Queensland had fallen 10.8% on a per capita basis. When compared to the same time last year, the actual reduction, 6.5%. In Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kong to allow Guangdong vehicles up to 3-day stay under new cross-border travel scheme. The southbound travel scheme marks a major policy breakthrough that will open up a new travel mode for mainland China residents to Hong Kong, the Transport and Logistics Bureau said. Currently, the only mainland vehicles that can drive in Hong Kong are those belonging to Guangdong companies qualified under a scheme in the province. These companies have a limited quota of cars that can be driven on Hong Kong roads. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, documents allege a federal agent at Portland ICE threatened to shoot an ambulance driver. Feds delayed medics who had come to pick up an injured protester. Then, according to confidential incident reports, the agents became aggressive. The two reports, filed by different medical workers, mirror each other's accounts and are consistent with publicly available audio recordings of emergency medical services radio communications, as well as 911 calls and dispatch reports obtained under public records law. In the Salish Current, local television station broadcast news, views, community. One of the earliest cable networks in the country was built, neighborhood by neighborhood, by a Bellingham television pioneer. Rogan Jones envisioned 1953-launched KVOS as a Bellingham TV station, but a lack of sufficient ad revenue soon turned his thoughts northward. In 2010, the last Bellingham staff members, by then fewer than two dozen, were laid off, and the station moved studios and offices to Seattle. In December 2023, KVOS switched its programming to the Spanish-language Univision network. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Chilliwack, now part of Metro Vancouver's troubled sewage plant project. And patronage by the pair. Health board honchos hired at Hydro. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to meteorologists. It is storm season up and down the West Coast, so a special thank you to the folks who keep their eyes on the skies so they can tell us what's coming our way at this rainy and windy time of year. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 19th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 19th of October in 1864, the St. Albans Raid in Vermont, Confederate soldiers pulled off a robbery of three banks and escaped to Canada? It was the northernmost land action of the American Civil War. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.